Today is President's Day, the amalgam created by combining what was once separate observances of Lincoln's birthday and Washington's birthday. Lincoln will be our focus in this hour, but in relation to Washington and the other creators of the United States of America. Today's guest points out just how much Abraham Lincoln came to rely on the wisdom of the so-called Founding Fathers. Richard Brookhiser's book is called Founder's Son, A Life of Abraham Lincoln. Richard Brookhiser works as a senior editor at the National Review and is the author of 11 books. Those include studies of three of the founding fathers, George Washington, Alexander Hamilton, and James Madison. Richard also wrote and hosted PBS documentaries on Washington and Hamilton, so well-versed in the founders. Richard Brookhiser, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
Is this just a natural next after studying the founding fathers, seeing where their wisdom went in the early decades of the Republic?
Well, it's natural because Lincoln invoked them so frequently. When his mature political career begins in 1854, when the Missouri Compromise is effectively repealed, and he said that's roused him as he had never been roused before. And then, so from 1854 really through the Gettysburg Address, there's hardly a major speech he gives that does not point to the Founding Fathers. And he says that their policy on slavery is his policy and the policy of the Republican Party, and he relies on them for arguments and for inspiration and for credit. I mean, he's saying this is I'm not just making this up myself. This is the opinion of the people who founded this country.
There's an early vignette in the book of Lincoln giving a speech on the founders in 1838, not long after the last of them died. I mean, was he unusual at that point in history in his reverence for them, or were people talking about the founding fathers in the same sorts of way that members of Congress do today?
Well, there was a lot of reverence for them, and it was heightened by the fact that they had finally gone. In the 1830s, the very last of them, a handful of individuals, James Madison, a few others, they finally die. And so America is faced with this loss of people who had won our independence and created our Constitution. And so lots of politicians are invoking them. One of Lincoln's tasks throughout his life is to establish that his interpretation is better than the interpretations of his rivals.
In other words, the ones who would say, no, the founders did say slavery was a good thing.
Well, nobody says that. Interestingly, what they do say, for instance, Stephen Douglas, who's a fellow Illinois politician, he and Lincoln know each other for years. They're not unfriendly, although they're constant political rivals. But Douglas's argument is that the founders made a country that was mixed. It was half slave, it was half free. He says that's worked well for us. Illinois is a free state, but just to the south, Kentucky, Missouri to our west, those are slave states. That's fine. We can keep this system going forever. Lincoln's response to that is that the founders did not make it half slave and half free. They found it that way. Slavery preceded them by more than a century. They did not know how to end it. They deplored it. They said in the Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal, and they meant that, and they believed that. They didn't know how to bring that about practically, but they did have policies that would restrict the expansion of slavery and also cut off the source of new slaves by allowing the slave trade to be ended in 1808. So Lincoln says they hope to put it in the course of ultimate extinction. My rival, Stephen Douglas, doesn't care about that. I do. We have to get back to the founders' views.
In the book Founder's Son, you do walk us back into Lincoln's childhood and take us forward from there. Much has been said and written about Lincoln's self-education. How much schooling did he have, and why so little?
Well, if you add it all up, he went to 5 one-room schoolhouses in Kentucky and Indiana when he was a boy. But if you add up all that time, it's a year. What he learned was how to read and write and how to do mathematics up to the level of cross multiplication. These were practical skills. His father could not write. He could sign his own name, but he sent Abraham to school because he thought it would be useful, you know, to have these abilities. Where Lincoln was special was that he really took to reading. He took to learning. His stepmother, who survived him and was interviewed when she was an old lady, she recalled how he studied things when he was a boy. If he didn't understand something, he had to ask, what does this mean? Then he would write it down. Then he would try to rephrase it. He would work it around until he was satisfied that he grasped this idea, this topic, and then he'd go on to the next thing. So this was a, you know, his father's a subsistence farmer and a carpenter. They live not quite on the frontier, but you know, out there. He never sees a city until he's in his late teens, and he does go to New Orleans. But so this is a very rural and not prosperous life that he leads. He has an education that's comparable to a lot of the children who grow up around him, but he wants to take more advantage of it.
It's amazing what he was able to learn, given what little formal education he had. It's amazing, 1 year of formal schooling in a string of 5 schoolhouses. Many details like that in Founder's Son, A Life of Abraham Lincoln. Richard Brookhiser compares Lincoln to the Founding Fathers and talks about the wisdom Lincoln picked up from them and put to use. We'll come back to the discussion, and you can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange when we return with Richard Brookhiser in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Richard Brookhiser, senior editor of the National Review, author of 11 books, including the most recent one, Founder's Son, A Life of Abraham Lincoln, a comparison of Lincoln with the Founding Fathers, and a look at what he learned from the Founding Fathers and put to use in his life. You can join us on the Exchange as we talk about Lincoln and his wisdom and that he borrowed from other people. 800-838-3760 throughout our listening area. 800-838-3760 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. We're just talking in passing about Lincoln's father, and he was able to sign his name and read a little. There is a comparative riff in here about the Founding Fathers and Lincoln's father, Thomas. How much did Lincoln revere or not Thomas Lincoln?
It was a difficult relationship. I don't think they ever really saw eye to eye. Lincoln's stepmother did get him. Don't think his father did. We're not sure about his mother. She died when he was 9, and we don't have a lot of clear accounts of her. One thing that Thomas Lincoln did that Abraham did not like is he would hire him out as a laborer once he becomes a teenager, once he reaches his full growth and he's a strong kid, you know, so his father would hire him out to other people who wanted to have fields cleared or rails split or whatever, and all the wages that Abraham would earn, the father would keep. Now, this was not an uncommon practice at that time in the early 19th century. But common practices can take different people different ways, and Abraham bitterly resented that. And I think it may have played an unconscious role in his, or even a conscious role in his dislike of slavery when he came to think seriously about that, because he himself had felt what it was like to labor without wages.
Involuntary labor that somebody else profits from.
That's right. That you don't get any share of. The one thing they did have in common, although Abraham never acknowledged it, is apparently they were both great storytellers. We know there were two cousins of the Lincolns who spent a lot of time with the Lincoln family. One of them lived with the Lincoln family for a number of years. And when they were older men, they both said that Thomas Lincoln was an excellent storyteller. One of them said he was even better than Abe Lincoln. And of course, Abe Lincoln was a terrific storyteller, and he used that talent throughout his political career, mainly as a way of putting people at ease, sometimes of distracting them. If you make them laugh, you don't necessarily have to do what they've come to you for. So he could use stories in that way. He also just liked them, liked to tell them. And I think he got that talent from his father.
I wonder if we're maybe overly critical of politicians in the current day for telling little homilies and things like that, little homespun stories, or at least they sound like that, to illustrate points they're trying to make politically, when it sounds like one of the most revered presidents in the country was very good at that sort of thing.
Well, sure. I mean, and if you do it well, stories fix things in the mind, and they illustrate things, they make them vivid, and they make them memorable. And it's an ancient technique. It's older than writing, undoubtedly. It's a little priggish to disdain it.
Among the books that Abraham Lincoln kept on hand, he had Parson Weems' work on Washington, which has the story of the cherry tree, etc. Was any of that book truthful?
Weems did a lot of homework. He did actually, look up people who were, old people by the time he's writing, to try and get anecdotes about George Washington's youth. What's interesting about Weems' life, which was a very popular book, and how Lincoln used it, is that Lincoln doesn't use the story that we're most familiar with, which is Washington and the cherry tree, accidentally chopping it with a hatchet that he's given as a boy, and then his father asks him, what happened, and he says, "I can't tell a lie, I did it." And then the father praises him for his honesty. That didn't make an impression on Lincoln. What did make an impression, and we know this because Lincoln said so himself, in 1861, when he's on his way to his first inauguration, Lincoln passes through Trenton, New Jersey, and he's addressing the state legislature. He's the president-elect. And he recalls Weems' Life of Washington. He said, I had this book as a boy, and what most impressed me was the accounts of the revolutionary battles, and none more so than the Battle of Trenton. And then he briefly talks about the crossing of the Delaware and the struggle with the Hessians. But then Lincoln says, boy though I was, it struck me that there must have been something important, more important even than a struggle for independence, that those men were fighting for. And what that was liberty. And if you go back to Weems' Life of Washington, that is exactly how he depicts the Battle of Trenton. He as the American troops have crossed the Delaware and are marching on to Trenton to engage the Hessians, Weems says there's an allegorical figure hovering over them. It's a woman, the spirit of liberty. And he says she's been driven out of Europe. America is her last refuge. But her enemies have come here with armies to attack her. Who will defend her? Only this little band of men. So Weems is presenting the Battle of Trenton as a struggle for liberty in the world, and Lincoln reads this as a boy, and then he remembers it as a man, as he's going to Washington, D.C. to be inaugurated, and in his mind, the struggle at Trenton is now going to have to be reproduced in his own day and generation.
And indeed it was. Some of the other things about Lincoln's childhood that come through a little more boldly in your book than I think I'd heard before, things like the illegitimacy of Lincoln's mother. And there's an interesting story he told about her father.
Yes, he only told this once, so far as we know. He told it when he was in a buggy with his law partner, a younger man named William Herndon, 9 years younger, and they were law partners for 16 years. And Herndon is a source for a lot of what we know about Lincoln before he becomes president. But so they're riding along, and Lincoln says, kind of out of the blue, that his own mother was illegitimate, and that her father, her actual father, was some noble Virginian. And then Lincoln goes on, and he attributes all his abilities and talents to this supposed grandfather of his, who was this wealthy, educated Virginian. Now, you know, no genealogist has ever confirmed anything like this. No one around Lincoln ever said anything like this. There was a lot of gossip about Lincoln's mother's family, and, you know, people would say, oh, you know, Lincoln's ancestor was this guy or that guy, but nothing like this noble Virginian. So what I think this is a fantasy. He's just, you know, he's trying to explain to himself, why was I so unusual? I mean, I know I wasn't like my father. My stepmother liked me, but I wasn't related to her. Where did it all come from? Well, maybe, you know, and everybody, you know, people said my mother was illegitimate. Well, she must have, you know, she must have slept with some special guy. I mean, it's a fantasy. But apparently Lincoln entertained this, only said it once, so far as we know.
Do you think he was trying to come up with an explanation for why he ended up a relatively smart fella?
Yes, I think it was that. And also he picks, you know, and his family on both sides was originally from Virginia, but he's picking, you know, a noble Virginian. He's not saying, oh, it was Thomas Jefferson or George Washington. He's not picking some individual, but he's imagining that he's descended from someone in that cohort. You know, so he's romantically linking himself to this founding generation. Now, of course, the important link that he had was that he read them and that he understood them. I mean, that's what counts. It's not, you know, who his grandfather might have been.
Yeah, it's the important point of the book, The Founder's Son, or just called Founder's Son, A Life of Abraham Lincoln. Richard Brookhiser is its author and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. And you may join the discussion of Lincoln, his life, and his use of the founder's wisdom. 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area. 800-838-3760, by email jx@jeffnet.org. And so, Richard, can you point to a period in Abraham Lincoln's life in which he began to study the founders in earnest?
Well, he starts talking about them seriously in 1854, and this was a great upheaval in American politics. The Compromise of 1850 had settled the status of slavery in every territory that the United States owned, and we had just acquired a lot of it from Mexico, having won the Mexican War 2 years earlier. But then in 1854, Stephen Douglas, Lincoln's longtime rival in Illinois politics, much more successful, he's a U.S. senator and a very potent one, he introduces a bill to organize the territories of Kansas and Nebraska. And this is the remainder of the Louisiana Purchase, which has not yet become states or territories. And that territory had been set aside as a free territory as long ago as 1820. But now, 34 years later, Douglas is saying, let's have a territorial government for Kansas and Nebraska, and the people who live there can choose whether it'll be a free territory or a slave territory. And this was Douglas's policy. He called it popular sovereignty. We'll let the people who live there vote on whether they want to have a free state, free territory, or slave territory, and presumably freer slave states later. And this enrages Northern opinion. It stirs up Abraham Lincoln. that gets him into politics more vigorously than he's been for the last few years. He gives a three-hour speech in Peoria, Illinois, which really sets the direction for the rest of his life. And he, in it, it's this long analysis of the Nebraska bill and why it's wrong, it's ahistorical, it'll have bad effects, you know, this, that, and the other thing. But his main point is that this is violating the policy of the founders, who wanted to restrict the expansion of slavery. And he says, our Republican robe is soiled and trailed in the dust. Let us turn and wash it white in the spirit of the revolution. So he is invoking the revolutionary generation and the founding fathers against Stephen Douglas and this new policy.
Richard Brookhiser is the author of Founder's Son. Here's Wayne in Wolf Creek. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call. Many refer to the Federalist Papers these days as if they were part of or defining the Constitution. Did Lincoln specifically use the Federalist Papers, or could you put him perhaps in context, or the two in context for me? And I'll take listen to the comments off air.
All right. Thank you, Wayne.
Sure. Lincoln does not refer to the Federalist Papers a lot, or I don't know. Can't recall if he referred to them at all. What he knows about the founders, he gets from a reference work called Eliot's Debates, which was published in the 1830s, and that collected a number of documents having to do with the Revolution and with the Constitution. So you do have some of the debates on the Constitution that happened in state ratifying conventions, there in Eliot's Debates. When James Madison publishes his Notes of the Constitutional Convention in 1840, Lincoln also has access to those. He clearly cites things from Madison's notes. So those are the kinds of resources that he's using to get back to what the founders were saying.
You mentioned the 1854 Peoria speech, but when he was in the Illinois legislature, he and a fellow legislator entered a protest on slavery into the record, and that was several years before that, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, that was 1837. And it's interesting because it shows Lincoln's early interest in the question of slavery, and it shows he's interested in it even though there's no chance that his protest is going to affect anything. What happened is that southern states were asking northern legislatures to condemn abolitionist societies. Abolitionism as a movement was really getting going. There were abolitionist newspapers and publications. Southern slave-owning states bitterly resented this. They wanted northerners to condemn abolition. So the Illinois legislature votes, yes, we think abolition is a terrible idea. And Lincoln does too, by the way. He thinks the abolition movement is too extreme, and that is a position that he consistently held. But he and one other legislator, there are only two of them in the whole legislature, they issue what they call a protest, and the two of them say, yes, we do agree that abolitionism is extreme. However, we want it read into the record that we think that slavery is bad policy and founded in bad morality. So it's interesting that they're just making that point. And then they go on to say that the federal government should consider eliminating it in the District of Columbia, which is something that Congress had the power to do, because Congress directly controlled the District of Columbia, and that had slavery, that allowed slavery. And they said Congress should consider eliminating it in the district if the residents of the district support that.
And in fact, Lincoln himself got to Congress in the late 1840s and proposed ending slavery in the district. And how did that go at that time?
It had so little support that he didn't even make it as a formal bill. He thought he had the backing of some people in the district, including the mayor, the mayor of Washington, D.C. Lincoln was a Whig, which was a political party that lasted for about 20 years in the 1830s and 40s. And this mayor of Washington, D.C. was also a Whig, and Lincoln thought he was on board with this idea. But once Lincoln spoke about it on the floor of Congress, all these people backed off and were nowhere to be found. So Lincoln didn't even formally propose his measure as a bill, and it, you know, it just died.
A lot of things in the book open some eyes, including your reference to the fact that the Constitution, as originally written, never used the word slavery. Did Lincoln think it would die through attrition or something?
Well, he thought that the founders hoped that it would, that if you prevented it from expanding and if you cut off the slave trade, they thought that it would wither away. Now, of course, when the Civil War happens, that all bets are off.
Much more to talk about with Richard Brookhiser, the author of Founder's Son, A Life of Abraham Lincoln. It's drawn in the context of Lincoln using the wisdom of the Founding Fathers. And you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we come back. Back with Richard Brookhiser and you in a minute 25. Final segment on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. On this President's Day, we're talking about Abraham Lincoln in the context of the book by Richard Brookhiser, senior editor of the National Review, author of 11 books, including three about the Founding Fathers. This book is called Founder's Son, A Life of Abraham Lincoln. It places Lincoln's work in the context of the wisdom he drew from the Founding Fathers as he approached his increasingly important work in his life. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 with questions or comments. Emails go to jx@jeffnet.org. So to specific founders, Thomas Paine, for example, I mean, he wrote stuff in the Age of Reason that caused a real blow-up, you point out.
Yes, well, Paine, Paine argues, he's an Englishman who comes to this country just before the Revolution and is very, very much in favor of the Revolution. And he argues for American independence even before the Continental Congress declared it. And he wrote a lot of great patriotic journalism during the Revolution. It's what he's most famous for. But in the 1780s, he writes a major book. He calls it The Age of Reason. And it is a ferocious attack on organized religion. He has a little mockery of Islam, and he has more of Judaism, but his main target is Christianity, which is what he knows best and what most of his readers are. And the book had an interesting history. It sort of destroyed his reputation in this country as a respectable friend and ally of the Founding Fathers. But it did find an audience. It was available throughout the 19th century, and Lincoln read Paine in Illinois when he's a young man in his 20s. And this is the age where, like a lot of people, he's left home. He's on his own now. He's independent. His parents were Baptists, and he attended their church services. But now he's feeling his oats, and he reads Paine, and, you know, Paine says, well, the Bible is full of holes and contradictions, and, you know, Christianity believes X, Y, and Z, and it's all ridiculous. And Lincoln swallows this. He thinks this is just great. And there is one story that as a young man he was telling his pals that he had himself written a pamphlet reflecting Paine's views. And he intended to get this printed. And an older man who was there when they were having this discussion, he asked to see it, and he put it in the stove. And the reason he did that is because young Lincoln was already interested in politics. So the older man was doing him a favor. He was, you know, you're not going to get ahead in politics in Illinois in the 1830s if you're writing pamphlets saying that Jesus Christ was not the Son of God. So that was that for Lincoln's public career as a skeptic. He learned to keep these opinions to himself. And then at some point in his life, they changed. They did change. And that's clear from, it's most clear from the second inaugural in 1865, which is really a sermon. I mean, it is by far the most religious inaugural address that has ever been given. And it's Lincoln, brooding on God's purpose in permitting the Civil War and trying to explain its meaning, which is miles from Thomas Paine. Although, you know, he was influenced by it when he was a young man, and I think what he permanently took from Paine was a style of argument where you could make serious points by using humor. That is one thing Paine does very well, and you don't have to agree with him to appreciate his success at doing that. And I think, Lincoln was already a good humorist himself. He was a good storyteller. But Paine shows him how you can use humor to make serious points.
The humor and the ability to take a punch in a sense and come back with it certainly proved to be a benefit to Lincoln once he began debating Stephen Douglas. And as you point out, it wasn't just the Lincoln-Douglas debates in the 1858 Senate campaign, but they really had what amounted to an intermittent debate starting in 1854, which is a key year you already mentioned here. Douglas obviously, though, thought that he too was doing the work of the founders. And how well did he read and interpret the work of the founders, do you think?
Well, the founders did believe in popular government, so Douglas is right about that. He's wrong. Lincoln would say he's wrong in that the founders laid down principles which should set the limits for it. I mean, there are certain boundary lines here. One of them is that all men are created equal. And Douglas says, well, that only meant white men of European descent. It's one of the things he says in the Lincoln-Douglas debates. It does not mean the Negro. It doesn't mean Indians. It doesn't mean Fijis or Malays. I mean, he's quite specific about who doesn't count here. And, you know, Lincoln's answer to that is no. I mean, all men means all men. And you know, he's, as a historian, I have to say he's right about that. Jefferson was a slave owner, but Jefferson knew what the English language meant, and that is what he meant. And like Lincoln, Jefferson also deplored slavery and hoped it would end. He didn't do very much practical to bring that about. I mean, he did write the Declaration of Independence, and that's a huge thing, and Lincoln made great use of it. But I think Lincoln's understanding of what Jefferson thought was more accurate than Stephen Douglas's.
Let's take another phone call. We have Doug in Casper, California on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, you actually just addressed one of my questions. I got a couple, but I'll ask it anyway. I've read two books recently, Washington by Chernow and Doris Kearn Goodwin, Gang of Rivals, which is the basis of both my questions. First one is, I wonder if Lincoln acknowledged the fact that Washington and Jefferson were both slave owners and evidently were allowed brutal treatment of their slaves. The other one is, I wonder if you could comment about what I understand is that Lincoln believed that slaves were inferior to whites, although he did believe evidently they should be free. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Doug.
Well, Lincoln was aware that Washington and Jefferson and many of the other founders were slave owners, but what he always did was he quoted their public pronouncements on liberty and on slavery. Washington did write letters in which he deplored slavery and hoped that the legislature might end it. And Washington did free all his slaves in his will, unlike Jefferson. Now Lincoln does say in the 1850s when he's running against Douglas that he believes that black people are inferior to white people. I mean, he does say that, but he says the more important thing is that they are people, and that it is wrong to hold any person in slavery. Now, his notion in the 1850s, and this was not uncommon in those days, it was a thing called colonization, and the idea was that, well, perhaps if we are able to free all the slaves someday, they can be encouraged to move back to Africa. This is how the country of Liberia was started. It was the result of American colonization experiments in sending former American slaves to Africa. But Lincoln, once the Civil War gets going, he abandons these views. He does have a meeting in the White House with some free blacks from Washington, D.C., and tries to pitch the idea of colonization to them, and nobody is buying it. The most important thing is the behavior of black soldiers in the Union Army. The Emancipation Proclamation, one of its provisions is that there will be the Army and the Navy also will be open to the enlistment of black soldiers and sailors. Black men take advantage of this, and they fight very gallantly in the Civil War. And this impresses Lincoln. He's the commander in chief. He knows what's going on. He reads all the battle reports. And so by the end of the war, he says publicly in the last speech of his life, this is after Appomattox, that he hopes that black veterans and very intelligent black men will be allowed to vote in the state of Louisiana. Now, Louisiana was one of the Confederate states, but it was applying to be readmitted to the Union. And Lincoln says publicly that he hopes the Louisiana Constitution will, in the future, allow black veterans and intelligent black men to vote. And one of the people who heard that speech was John Wilkes Booth, and he turned to a friend and said, that means nigger citizenship. That's the last speech he'll ever give.
And it was. One of the things here that William Herndon, you mentioned he was a source of a lot of information about Lincoln, mentioned that Lincoln hated Thomas Jefferson as a man. Was that supported by anything else that you could find?
Well, that's just Herndon's say-so. So, and Herndon gets some things wrong, but he tries to be very scrupulous. He never says anything that he knows to be wrong. So I tried to figure out what could Herndon have meant by that, and I think what he's probably talking about is as Thomas Jefferson ages, when he's president after he's president, and he still worries about slavery and he writes about it, but he's so reluctant to do anything about it. And there was one man that Lincoln would certainly have been aware of because he was a figure in Illinois politics, a man named Edward Coles. And he was the generation between Jefferson and Lincoln. So he's younger than Jefferson, older than Lincoln. And he knew Jefferson very well. He was a young protege of Jefferson's. And he's from a slave-owning family. But when he's a young man, he actually frees all his slaves, all the slaves he's inherited. He takes them to Illinois, which is a free territory, and gives them their freedom. And then he becomes governor of Illinois. So he's someone, a figure in the history of Illinois politics. And he tries to get Jefferson, when Jefferson's an old man, to make a statement about slavery, to come out against it in some practical way, to hope, all right, let's get a movement going to really get to work here and end it. And Jefferson writes him back and says, slavery is wrong, it shouldn't exist, but he says this is a task for the young. Now, and Lincoln will refer to Jefferson's letter to show that Jefferson still opposed slavery even to the end of his life, but he had to have read that part of it. This is a task for the young, which means I don't want any part of this. Huh. I'm not going to do this myself. So there's the wonderful principle, you know, well expressed. Thomas Jefferson expresses everything well. But then there's the hesitation, the personal failure of follow through. And I think that's what William Herndon was referring to when he said that Lincoln hated Jefferson as a man, or rather as a politician.
Were there any founders who were so ardently anti-slavery that Lincoln could point to them for wisdom, but they might have been reluctant to do so?
Well, he does mention in the Cooper Union Address, which was his sort of debut as a candidate for the Republican nomination in 1860, and this was a 90-minute speech that he gave in New York City, and half of it is about the Founding Fathers and their opinions of slavery in the territories. And he mentions Benjamin Franklin and Alexander Hamilton, who belonged to manumission societies in their own states. Franklin in Pennsylvania, Hamilton in New York. He mentions them as noted anti-slavery men. He also mentions Governor Morris, who was the draftsman of the Constitution. He's the man who actually puts it in its final form of words. And we know from James Madison's notes of the Constitutional Convention that Morris gave some blazing anti-slavery speeches in Philadelphia in 1787. So Lincoln was aware of the records of these men, and he refers to them. But he's very careful to focus on what they did in public life, votes they took. And in the Cooper Union Address, he's pointing out that 21 of the men who signed the Constitution voted to restrict slavery in the territories at some point. So he says that was their policy. It's also mine. Let's do it.
We learn a whole lot about Abraham Lincoln from this book, Founder's Son, A Life of Abraham Lincoln. Richard Brookhiser wrote it, and he's joined us on The Exchange. Thank you so much for your time today, Richard.
Thank you for having me.
Pleasure.